This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, universe. Welcome to a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, my name is Dan. How are you doing? Thank you so much for coming back. This is the show where we take a tour of the galaxy, learning about all the most amazing, weird and wonderful things that are happening right now in the name of science. Now, today, we'll take a look at how happy dolphins are, because there's been a study that's been trying to find out if they enjoy their life. Also, we'll talk about a jungle insect that has poisonous legs. And we'll chat to a man who can reveal if the octopus is really an alien. Honestly, if this is news to you, octopuses being aliens, it's seriously an idea that's being considered by scientists. And we'll find out if there's any truth in it in a sec. First, a quick takeoff with the Deep Space High gang.
Deep Space High, marvellous missions with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
This term's assignment is to write your very own universe handbook. You'll want to cram it full of all the basic things you need to know about space exploration. Yeah, the nuts and bolts of it all. So, let's crack on. Talking of nuts and bolts, Electra, do you think this term you might just remember to tighten your screws to stop various robot limbs from impeding my progress across the room?
Sorry, sir.
Let's start at the beginning. What's the first thing you need to do when you're planning a journey into space?
Make sure you've inflated your lunar lilo.
I thought the holiday might have calmed you lot down. Fat chance. The first thing you need to do is work out where you're going. Have a good look at what's out there. So, how do we observe space?
We use a telescope.
Telescopes aren't the only way to observe space, you know, Alex.
Telescopes are, however, a great place to start. Much better than just using our eyes. Sorry, I'd forgotten you've only got the one blurb. Very nice it is too. So, telescopes, how do they work?
The standard optical telescope works by reflecting or refracting large quantities of light from the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum to a focal point observable through an eyepiece.
Or basically, it scoops up a load of light and squeezes it down to a small point on your eye, where the image appears a lot bigger than it started.
That's what I said!
You're both right. But optical telescopes only work for the visible universe. Stuff our eyes, or eye, sorry blurp, can see.
Well, that's when you need a radio telescope, or an infrared telescope, or even an X-ray telescope.
Cool. Are they like X-ray specs? Can they see through walls?
Behave, Alex. Stats is right. Those sorts of telescopes can pick up waves our eyes can't see to give us even more information about the universe, including images. And infrared telescopes are particularly handy because they also give us information about the temperature of a planet. Have a look at this projection of an infrared image.
It might be infrared, but it's blue. Looks chilly.
You'd be right. This planet has been covered in ice for billions of years. What about this one?
Well, it's red and orange in swirls. Is it a hot planet?
You're right. The red-coloured images show us that the temperatures on this planet are much higher.
Much more my style. Get the sunglasses on, crack open the sun cream.
And then you'd burst into flames on this particular planet. Still a bit hotter than you used to, Alex. A toasty 3,000 degrees. So telescopes can tell us what's out there and how hot or cold they are. But if we're going to visit, we'll need to know how far we have to go. And how do we measure distance in space?
Sat-nav?
It'd have to be a blooming big one. No, there are many ways to measure distance in space, but the most common method is called parallax.
Parallax? Isn't that the horrible galactic lurgy that everyone in school got last year?
No, Stats, although it does sound a bit like a nasty disease. Parallax is better shown than explained. If you hold your thumb in front of your face and look at it first with your right and then with your left eye, can you tell me what happens?
Weird. It looks like my thumb moves.
Bingo. It seems to move in relation to the background. How much it moves depends on how far away from your face it is. The distance to a star or planet can be measured by tracking its movement relative to other stars or planets further away. You have to take measurements from two places in our orbit to work it out. And the distance is given in light years.
If it's a distance, why is it measured in years? Shouldn't it be miles? And what's light got to do with it anyway?
The light year is used in astronomy because the universe is huge. The nearest star to your solar system, Alex, is Alpha Centauri, 24 trillion miles. And because the numbers are so big, scientists came up with a simpler unit. A light year is the distance that light travels in space in 1 year. It's around 6 trillion miles, give or take a bit. So Alpha Centauri is 4 light years away. Much simpler. That's the bell. Next time, we'll be having a think about how we prepare ourselves for deep space exploration.
Deep Space High. Marvellous missions with the Science and Technology Facilities Council.
To get another lesson in the furthest school in the solar system, you can, with the Deep Space High gang, download all their episodes for free on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. They're all on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. Do you remember a few weeks ago on the show, we learned that there is a slight chance that octopuses may have arrived on Earth from outer space? Do you remember this? It's because that they're so unique, they're so strange, and they're so, well, alien, I guess, that scientists are seriously considering they might be aliens after all. Well, we'll chat to an octopus expert in just a sec who can finally reveal the truth. Peter Godfrey-Smith, he's written the book on octopuses. He will be on the show from the other side of the world next. First, I want to say a quick hello to Alexa. She's got in touch saying that listening to this show is one of her favourite parts of the week. I've been thinking about this, Alexa. Is it because that you love science and you love learning about amazing things from the universe, or just because we put this show out on a Saturday so it reminds you that it's finally the weekend? I guess it doesn't matter, as long as you're having fun, Alexa. Now, well done. Thank you so much for getting in touch. Alexa got in touch with me over on the iTunes podcast store. And if you want to do that, if you want to say hello to the show, or if you've got a sciencey question that you want answered by an expert, that's the best place to do it. Get onto the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop your name on there so I know who you are, and say a little hello in the review box there. Now, a couple of weeks ago on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, we talked about the octopus and how secretly it may be from space. Now, we'll find out more today because the author Peter Godfrey-Smith, he's written the book Other Minds, The Octopus, The Sea and the Deep Origins of Consciousness, and he's on the phone now. Hey, Peter.
Hi, Dan.
Thank you so much for coming. You're all the way down under. Now, more about the octopus, because you said in the past that it's the closest thing that we will have to meeting an intelligent alien. What do you mean by that?
I meant that it has it has this combination. It's very far from us in evolutionary terms. I mean, it is, in a sense, one of our cousins, a very, very distant cousin, but one that's very far from us. So the common ancestor that you share with an octopus, and you share common ancestors with all animals, the common ancestor you share with an octopus lived about 600 million years ago. Despite that distance, they have big nervous systems, they're very complicated animals in what they do, and there can be a kind of encounter. When you meet an octopus, you can really feel you're meeting an animal that has a lot going on inside. So in that way, it's analogous to meeting an alien.
Now, In the world with evolution, it's survival of the fittest, so things evolve parts of their body for a reason. Why possibly would an octopus evolve 8 legs, a very slimy, morphing body that can change into whatever it wants, its massive head? Why has it developed the way that it has?
It is an amazing body. One way you can think about the 8 leg is, in a way, it's almost like they're 8 enormous lips, because we call them legs, but they are around the mouth. So the mouth is right in the middle of those 8 legs. And you can think of them as having evolved from a kind of fleshy area around the mouth. And if you're going to turn your mouth into a great big grasping machine, why not have 8?
And what do we think that it came from then? If we're talking that millions and millions and millions of years ago, humans descended from apes and bigger primates, what do we think led to the octopus under the sea?
Well, an octopus is a mollusk, so its relatives at the moment are things like oysters and clams and snails. And shellfish give us some guide to what its ancestors might have looked like. So if you go right back 500 million years or so and look for an octopus ancestor, you'd probably be looking for a shellfish, something a bit like a limpet, perhaps, which is a little flat shellfish that clings tightly to rocks in the sea. And mollusks have, in many cases, remained shellfish-like, but a group of them took off, essentially. They began swimming in the open water rather than clinging to the bottom, and acquired a whole bunch of features that make sense for a mobile animal, a swimming animal. From there, the big thing that the octopus group did, or the ancestors of the octopus, is they gave up any kind of shell. It's pretty unusual for a mollusk to give up its shell. I mean, there are slugs, which are mollusks that have no shell at all. But an octopus is a bigger and more complicated animal than a slug, and it gets around, it's a hunter. It does all this without the protection of a shell. And that really is a very unusual feature.
What do we know about how it lives? So what it thinks about, what it does to find the prey that it's hunting. Do we know anything about how it sees, what it then does with itself every day?
They have very good eyes, octopuses. They have eyes that are very similar in design to our eyes, but that evolved independently. So they have an eye with a lens that focuses an image on a retina, a lot like a camera. So this design is called the camera eye. We have a camera eye, and octopuses have a camera eye, and really those are just the two, the vertebrate design and the cephalopods, which include the octopus. These are the animals that have a camera eye, so they can see very well. And the way that they hunt is mostly just by feeling around and exploring. They're very exploratory animals. They roam around, often on rocky reefs, and feel around everything that they encounter. An octopus, those suckers on its arm, they taste everything that they touch. So if you imagine being an octopus, you're roaming around with your eight legs that are a bit like lips, and everything you touch, you're tasting. And you are hunting for things like crabs. Crabs are very much a favorite food of octopuses. Other shellfish like scallops, various fish and things like that. So you're an exploratory hunter with very good eye.
And you mentioned it being exploratory. What else do we know about its characteristics? So for instance, if we think of a dog is a very loyal animal. We think of some big cats, maybe lions. They're huge, aggressive predators some of the time. What characteristics can you tell us about the octopus?
Not that much is known about some of these questions. Humans have spent a lot more time hanging out with animals like dogs and cats, and we have a sense of how, you know, of what's going on inside. In the case of an octopus, they're not very well known. But one important thing about them that makes them very different from a dog is that they're mostly rather solitary animals. Dogs are very intrinsically social. They like being around other dogs, and the ones we've domesticated like being around people. Octopuses are more solitary. They mostly don't hang out with other octopuses very much, but they have to sometimes to mate and reproduce. And beyond that, it's hard to say. I mean, not that much work is done on octopuses in the field. They really are quite mysterious animals.
Let me paint you a picture, Peter. Millions and millions and millions of years ago, an asteroid crashes into the sea. Frozen in some liquid are some eggs, which then hatch to become what we know as the octopus. This was a news story that was doing the rounds a couple of weeks ago. Do you think there is any truth at all to that?
I don't think there is. I think that's it is really just a piece of science fiction. And the reason that we know it's not true is because of the relatedness that octopuses have to those other mollusks and to other animals. So if you look at the genes of any animal at their DNA, because DNA is passed down from parent to offspring and changing only slowly as it goes, you can tell who an animal is closely related to, who it's less closely related to, and you could see if it wasn't related to any other animal at all, which is what that octopus scenario would mean. And when they looked at the DNA of octopuses a few years ago now, in 2015, they saw the genes of an animal that was related to other shellfish, other mollusks, that had other relatives among the invertebrate animals, pretty much as you would expect, given the place that octopuses appear sphere to occupy in relation to other animals. So I think there's just too much evidence showing that octopuses, you know, they are related to other shellfish, they are related to animals like clams, and further away to animals like worms, and further away from that to animals like us. There's too much evidence of that sort for us to think there's any chance they came from space.
Ah, well, I mean, you've told me a lot about the octopus, but you've also, like, ruined my big dream in how I thought we'd finally be able to talk to extraterrestrials, but still. Peter Godfrey-Smith.
I'm sorry to have done that. I mean, I agree it's a wonderful image, but I just don't think it happened that way.
All right, Peter. Well, thank you anyway. Peter Godfrey-Smith is the author of Other Minds, The Octopus, The Sea, and The Deep Origins of Consciousness. Thank you so much, Peter, for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll talk about how one of the most epic toys around gets made in just a sec. First, let's do this week's Dangerous Dan, where we take a look at the most mean and deadly things in the world. And today, it's a creature that's got 100 different ways of poisoning you. The Peruvian giant yellow-legged centipede is half a metre of pure terror. It's one of the largest centipedes in the world, growing to 30 centimetres, and it's capable of overpowering lizards, snakes, frogs, mice, bats, birds, and humans should be pretty scared of it too. Now, it's purpley green, it's got this red head that looks like something from the fires of a volcano, and it's got yellowy orange legs, which is where it gets its name. Now, a pair of these legs are modified into forciples, which are like daggers, and they can stab a victim and inject toxic venom into its blood. And it's pretty creative with its attack too, the Peruvian giant yellow-legged centipede. It doesn't just scuttle around over leads playing in the dirt, waiting for prey. No, it can climb walls and ceilings where they use their legs to grab, hold, and poison a victim. Now, this thing, it might look like a rainbow, but it's actually a dark, toxic, furious storm. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, I know that they look like they smile a lot, but here's something. How happy are dolphins, really? We'll find out in just a sec. First, let's catch up with Fun Kids' favourite genius inventor, Sir Sidney McSprocket, who is finding out how things that you use every single day are made. And today, he's having a look at one of your most favourite toys.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Now, something that gets a lot of people a bit excited is slime. Not sure why myself. Slime's better off left in ponds, if you ask me. But it's a fun substance to play with. But how is slime made? Slime is made from mixing a number of chemical ingredients. A bit like mixing together ingredients to make a cake.
Step one.
The chemicals are mixed in large stainless steel tanks, and computers instruct hoppers to pour in just the right amounts of each ingredient.
Step two.
One of the chemicals is a polymer-based substance, not unlike the white glue you use at school. Polymer molecules are long chains which will give the slime its slippery feel.
Step three.
A gelling agent goes into, often something called sodium borate. This will make the slime sticky. Water is also added to get the slime to just the right consistency.
Step four.
Other ingredients include fragrance and colour. And to keep everyone safe, preservatives are added to prevent the slime from getting all rotten and germy. The ingredients are then mixed to create the right consistency of slime.
Step five.
Jars which hold the slime are loaded onto a conveyor belt that lines them up underneath nozzles, which will squirt the right amount of slime into each.
Step six.
And then a lid is added, and off the jars go to be boxed up. Of course, you needn't buy slime from a shop. It's a very simple recipe, and one you can make at home. Just add white school glue to some liquid detergent. Oh, but get an adult to help. Adults aren't always big fans of slime where it's not expected. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
It is time to take a look at what sciencey stuff has been in the news this week. Now, the oldest known footprints left by an animal have been discovered in China. Scientists think that they're 546 million years old. They were found near the Yangtze Gorge, but experts don't really know exactly where they're from because they were made so long ago. But they do know that this period of time was when the first animals started evolving. So that's narrowed their search a little bit. More on that as we get it. Also, a Canadian company backed by Bill Gates, who is one of the richest men in the world, is making headway in sucking all the carbon dioxide out of the air. Now, this is one of the proposed solutions to climate change, because very simply, there's too much carbon in the air. It's damaging the planet by making it warmer, so scientists are looking to remove it, take it out of the air. They're removing about a ton every day, but it costs a lot of cash to get that done. And finally, scientists have managed to measure dolphins' happiness. The experts were looking at them in a marine park near Paris, and they measured aspects of how they feel about being in captivity. They looked at things like physical posture and swimming speed to find out how the dolphins are really feeling, and they found that the better the human connects with the animal, the better the creature feels. Let's do another man versus animal challenge then. Every single week on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, we find out what's better, who are better, humans or animals. And we've done speed tests, we've done strength wars, we've done teamwork competitions. And today, it's kind of all about this.
If you smell what the Rock is cooking.
No, not who's best at working an oven or following a recipe, no. Today, our humans and animals are getting into the ring.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the competition is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. Today, it's a wrestling challenge. First up is Alexander Kuralin from Russia, who is considered by many to be the greatest wrestler of all time. And following him will be the Stag Beetle. Where's he gone?
Ah, there he is.
First to compete is Alexander Kuralin. And the contest has begun.
Alexander is best known for Greco-Roman wrestling, where competitors have to throw their opponents to the mat.
And he's certainly showing no mercy, moving quickly and grabbing his opponent.
Who's been pulled to the floor?
Alexander's sheer speed and strength show he's a serious grappler. The question is, how on earth can our tiny stag beetle better that? Well, now's his chance.
And he's off. This male stag beetle is using his jaws, his actual mouth parts, to wrestle his opponent. He's locked them over his opponent's jaws and is using the entire weight of his body to show who's in charge.
Alexander might wrestle for a job, but it's a life and death matter for the stag beetle. They wrestle to claim the best food, the best mate, and to the death. So there can only be one winner, the tough and determined stag beetle, winner of our Extreme Athlete Challenge.
Well done, beetle.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
Loads more Extreme Athlete Challenges that you can catch up with for free on your phone or tablet. Have a look wherever you get your podcasts from. You can probably download them through there. They're also on the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. That is it then for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We're back with another trip around the most mean, deadly, weird and wonderful places in the universe next week at the same time. Now, in the meantime, if you've got a sciencey question that's racking your brain, something that you heard at school that you just can't believe and you think, right, I need to ask Dan, and I need to get an expert to answer it for me. Well, the best thing to do is to let me know by dropping it as a review on the iTunes podcast store. So get on there, find the Fun Kid Science Weekly, let me know your name so I know who you are. 5 stars would be amazing, and just write down your question in the review, and then I will see it, and I'll get an expert on for you. While you're on iTunes, one of the best ways that you can find all of the brilliant Fun Kid Science series that we've got, they're on there. All your favourite podcast places over on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com too. And you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app. And as always, at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.